Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we continue our monthly Marine Biological Laboratory Falmouth Forum Lecture Series with a conversation with James Purcell. He served as director of the U.S. State Department's Bureau for Refugees Programs and director general of International Organization for Migration. He's also the author of We're in Danger, Who Will Help Us? Refugees and Migrants, A Test of Civilization. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you, Mindy.
So, Jim, what
Pleased
was the impetus
here.
For the book? Yeah, why did you want to write the book?
Well, before I start, Mindy, could I thank the Falmouth Forum Committee and the Marine Biological Laboratory for giving me this opportunity to talk with you about one of the most critical issues facing our country going forward. I really appreciate it.
You bet. So tell us what the impetus for the book was.
I wrote this book after completing my IOM directorship in Geneva, beginning in the around 2005-06. But as I wrote the first four chapters deals with Indochina, which is we'll hope we get a chance to talk about today. The third section deals with other areas of the world facing similar problems, and as I completed that, I said, maybe I ought to look and see what applicability the model that we developed might have today. That model was extremely successful. We were called in to deal with Indochina at the fall of Saigon in 2005. And we took a very weak organization, my team did, and the State Department. We recruited partners with other federal agencies, with the U.S. private sector, with international organizations, and created a model that we call global humanitarian cooperation. That worked. We applied that to the Southeast Asia Indochina crisis, and we saw extraordinary success. That program went
You talk in the book about what you call the refugee decade in the book. And,
yes.
And as you're saying, your work with the State Department team established precedents and principles for guiding later American and global humanitarian efforts.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about that work.
Well, in the early days, I was working under President Carter in his administration. We were besieged with just hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese getting in leaky boats or walking to non-communist countries, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia. We saw what we call the Cambodian Holocaust was at work, where almost a third of that country were killed by brutally. We saw the same problems in Laos. So we set up a mechanism that said we recognize as the UN Human Rights Declaration of Human Rights determined that every person is entitled to dignity. So we set up a place that allowed them a safe place to escape to. Then we started pursuing solutions to their particular problems, and many of them could return to other areas in Asia or other parts of the world. But most of them, because of fear of their life, had no choice but to go into to seek third country resettlement. So as the largest resettlement country and with other partners, we launched into the largest resettlement program in history. And over the next few years, we resettled almost 3 million people, about a third of them through something I call the Orderly Departure Program. Other countries did their share, and when that program came to an end, we had resettled perhaps maybe 3-4 million people throughout the world. We then tried to look at how do we augment resettlement with something we called voluntary repatriation, regional settlement, and we found that that was possible. But as I was as I was trying to devise an American system, I wanted to be guided by the established refugee definition. And let me read that for you. This is incorporated into our own legislation, the U.S. Refugee Act of 1980. A refugee is a person who, owing to a well-founded fear of persecution for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group or political opinion, is outside the country of his nationality and is unable or unwilling to avail himself or herself of the protection of that country, and who, not having a nationality and being outside, is unable to rely on their home country for protection. So I use all of those as principles, that we would regard every person as a person of dignity. If they needed to flee for reasons that are enumerated in this definition, we set up safe places for them to go. And after their safety was assured, we began to pursue solutions to their problems. And according to the orthodoxy of the international system, which we bought into the American program, the three solutions: voluntary repatriation will help you go home as a first priority, if that's possible. If not, we will help you resettle within your region, where ethnic and cultural and other ties are greatest. But if neither of those two options is available, we will make what we call third country resettlement available. But as a last resort, owing only if the other two are not possible. So I incorporated all of that into our U.S. program. We tried wherever refugees and not beyond Asia and all parts of the world to assure that we had safe asylum, that we tried to help people get back home. We tried to work with their governments to make that possible, and if not, to see that we could resettle them in the region. We'd help many African refugees resettle in Africa, many South Asians in their own region, many Central Americans in their region. But we had to always have available the option of third country resettlement when safety was such an issue and no other option was available. That's what we had to use primarily in Southeast Asia and a couple other places. But on the whole, most other refugee issues were settled by helping people go home or to resettle safely within their region. So those were key ingredients in our team's work.
Yeah, Jim, you talk about your admiration for two presidents in particular, Jimmy Carter, who you mentioned, and Ronald Reagan. And when people hear that, they might go, wait a minute, these are like, you know, polar opposites in some ways. But yet what they had in common was the fact that they made human rights a central part of their foreign policy, right?
Absolutely. One of the key ingredients in my approach that I spoke with both administrations about, that if we're to be successful, we have to say that our foreign policy allows us to put the victims in the center of our efforts. So centrality in foreign policy was critical. When Indochina, I'll take President Carter for example, he was a great example. Indochina was so big in the early days, the State Department apparatus was weak and was collapsing. In fact, when I arrived, there were three separate investigations of it. We had no money, and we had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of refugee lives at stake in Asia. And the non-communist governments, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, the ASEAN governments, decided that they would impose a moratorium September 30, 1979. No more. And, of course, that would have meant disaster because they were coming by the boatloads at that point. So Carter said, we're going to formulate a rescue effort because, you know, many of them are Vietnam War refugees We had withdrawn April 30, 1975, and left millions of people who had thrown in their lot with us unprotected. So I had to pull together a program with my colleague Richard Holbrooke, who was my counterpart in the East Asia Bureau, with Secretary Cy Vance and Deputy Warren Christopher. I knew that with no money and Congress thinking we ought to transfer our program to other agencies, we were going to have a difficult time just getting the money. But Carter decided we're going to go for broke. I sent him a decision memo saying, let's do 10,000 refugees a month in resettlement. Let's do a lot of other things in Asia, like setting up a medical clearance, English language training, other things. But it was all expensive. But Carter was being pressed by Holbrooke that that wasn't even enough. So he made a trip, went to an economic conference in Tokyo. On the way over, Holbrooke kept banging away at Carter the whole way that this won't do it. Mm-hmm. So when Carter got to a big conference, we'd call the next for the next day, a UN conference for Indochinese refugees. Carter announced, miraculous, I don't know how he did it, but we're going to do 14,000 refugee resettlements a month in this country. Nobody had ever done that before. And we didn't even know if we had the capacity to do that kind of work. But Carter made a decision that only a president could make. I was astounded. Obviously was pleased with that. But he told me that, or his administration told me, that, look, you work the Hill, the congressional committees, and said, I'll lend the president's support, and we'll get it. And we did. And as a result of Carter's effort, we launched the largest resettlement program in history. And it worked. And I look back many years later, and I say, gosh, what if Carter had been like most, scared of the financial implications, unwilling to strike out and do something really decisive, none of this would have happened. So I give Jimmy Carter a lot of credit for what is now, the Indochina program, is now regarded by most in this business as the gold standard.
Right.
And I give a lot of credit to Jimmy Carter for that.
For doing that, yeah. We're talking with James Purcell. He's an expert on U.S. refugee and immigration history, international human rights resolutions, the U.S. 1980 Refugee Act, and global migration solutions developed under his purview from 1979 to 1986. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. Today it's our monthly Marine Biological Laboratory Falmouth Forum Lecture Series. We're having a conversation with James Purcell. He served as Director of the U.S. State Department Bureau for Refugee Programs and Director General of International Organization for Migration. He's the author of We're in Danger, Who Will Help Us? Refugees and Migrants, A Test of Civilization. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Let's talk about President Reagan for a second, Jim. This is interesting. Obviously, we're going to remember we're in a lot of tension during this time period with the Soviet Union. And talk about the conversations between the big important issues. We're talking about trade, arms, human rights was right up there with these conversations.
Yes. Reagan... when the Reagan administration began, I was a senior person brought over from the Carter years. So I was expecting to be reassigned, because most political leaders are. When Reagan came in, he told my boss, George Shultz, I want this job in the refugees is not political. I want you to find the best person you can for it. I had worked with George Shultz and OMB many years before, and we were fairly close colleagues. So George asked me to stay on. I was the only person that I can remember who transited both the Carter and the Reagan years. So we had a period of incredible continuity. Reagan was Cold Warish, anti-Soviet Union, or critical of the Soviet Union. In fact, he didn't even talk to them in his first administration, his first term. In his second term, he told Shultz to go to Geneva, talk to the Soviets, and find some areas where we could work together. Shultz did, and he came back and he said, "Mr. President, I think, as you mentioned, Mindy, trade and human rights and arms control were possibilities." So Reagan set up, asked Shultz to arrange a summit with Gorbachev. To make a long story short, there were three summits, one, that one in Geneva, one in Iceland, and the last one in Moscow. And at the first summit, Reagan threw the issue of refusenik, Soviet Jews, plumply in the middle of the table. And he said, because he had been following the plight of Soviet Jews, knew that they had been persecuted and harassed back even to the time of the Czars. Many of them were still underground, had no freedoms, hard to get jobs. They were severely persecuted by the Soviet government. Gorbachev didn't want to talk about that. He wanted to talk about trade and arms control, because his country was in an economic shambles at that point. So they couldn't really agree on anything at the Geneva conference. But Reagan had staked out his turf. They called a special meeting that occurred in Reykjavik, Iceland, because Shultz thought they had made substantial progress in all three areas. So at Iceland, Gorbachev and Reagan negotiated for a day, and they came out, they were in great agreement on a major arms deal, a major trade deal. But Gorbachev, at the end, as they got ready to go, Gorbachev told Reagan, "Well, I suppose now that we've made progress in these two areas, that means you'll give up on this human rights stuff, because this is really an irritant for me back home." And Reagan stood up and said, "Absolutely not. Unless human rights, the Soviet Jews are in the bargain, we have no deal." So they left very discouraged. Shultz and Gorbachev's foreign minister worked hard. They got to a point that Gorbachev, in the final conference, agreed that we would open up resettlement for Soviet Jews. They negotiated an agreement that had a massive trade deal, one of the most miraculous arms control agreements in history, and the openings that led to the freedom of movement for over a million Soviet Jews. At one point, Reagan and Shultz were at a meeting of the CSCE, the Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe, prior to the third summit, and the question had been raised about what Reagan would be willing to accept. So Shultz wanted to be clear, and Reagan wanted to be clear, that everybody knew the terms. So he said, "Unless we see progress in human rights, there will be no deal on trade and no deal on arms control." Now that's, in my way I look at it, that's called putting the victims in the center of foreign policy. Mm-hmm. Reagan was great at it. What we saw after that was a massive outpouring of Soviet Jews. Efforts were made inside the Soviet Union to improve the cultural life and viability of Jews that remained there. A major improvement. A large part of that, I think, was due to Reagan, who, like Carter, was willing to put the victims in the center of foreign policy, without which very little creatively is possible.
Yeah. So, Jim, what happened to the precedent set in that refugee decade? When and how did refugees go from being honored to being dishonored?
Well, when I came back, when I was writing my book, Mindy, I decided to test out whether the mechanisms, the models, procedures that I developed would work currently. So I decided to use one country. So I picked Syria, which was bubbling at that point. What I found was that the precedents, the procedures, the model that we had developed had been discarded, almost unremembered. And I said, this can't be. You know, we've got to bring that model back out. But I decided to dig into the Middle East and to look at Syria particularly. What I found was that the Middle East was an area which had been plagued for a number of years by a number of countries, and America was among them. Let me recall just a few things that happened there. In 1990, George Bush assembled a coalition to drive Saddam out, but left him in power. George W. Bush ordered a preemptive strike to eliminate weapons of mass destruction and found none. And he put an official in place there to guide reconstruction who met with failure. What we saw there is that an inevitable sectarian crisis was accelerated, magnified, lengthened. The seeds of continuing Middle East destruction were put in place. Saddam's continuing oppression led to the Arab Spring in 2011. When Mr. Obama came into power, he removed, you might recall, preemptive strikes against Libya's Gaddafi, which was surprising to me because Gaddafi had already eliminated his weapons of mass destruction and was providing critical intelligence to the U.S. So Libya was plunged into a black hole of chaos, anarchy, and despair. Barack Obama threatened red lines when chemical weapons were used in Syria. Said we would withdraw if he did another attack, and he attacked again, and we didn't withdraw. Obama also removed needed American troops at critical times. And then Trump came in. He did help with the defeat of ISIS, but was inconsistent in his policies, did not support our partners, the Syrian Kurds, and withdrew most of our troops at a very difficult time. So that accumulating Middle East crisis, the damaging aspects of it, can best be seen in Syria. Syria began with the Arab Spring and Daraa in 2011, when students revolted. They painted on the school wall the slogan, "The people want to topple the regime." Well, what happened is the troops came out, they routed the students and the protesters. Assad responded with brute force. Civil war engulfed Syria and Libya soon thereafter. In Iraq, U.S. troops were withdrawn, and the Shiite prime minister turned the U.S.-trained forces into a radical sectarian force, which was called ISIS, which engulfed both Syria and Iraq. Syria was devastated by war and destruction. By 2015, more than 22.4 million population had been displaced within Syria. Most of them fled to neighboring countries or were killed. But they were in asylum in many European countries. By 2015, many of these young Syrian students, which were in asylum, mainly in Turkey, Lebanon, decided that they didn't want to stay there any longer. So they picked up and they decided that they would go directly to Germany and France and England. Chancellor Merkel at that time decided that the right entry into Germany would be unrestricted. I think at that point, Europe made a massive blunder I had visited there with many of the officials, and I said, look, this is exactly the same point in the Southeast Asia crisis that I employed something I called global humanitarian cooperation. I pulled them together. I set up asylum centers around the region so people could come safely while we tried to solve their problems. I would not let people go unvetted, unknown people go into major countries of asylum without some first effort to provide some knowledge of who they were. Mm-hmm. At that point, they went to Germany, requested political asylum. Many bad elements got into Germany at that time. There was no vetting. Nobody knew who they were. There was no preparation for them. So a new system was born. The Americans, by the way, stood on the sidelines and watched this catastrophe in Europe occur, offering no help. During that time, the Americans were doing virtually nothing other than supporting a military effort. Yeah. But it didn't take long for the system of global humanitarian cooperation to vanish. Subsequent crises around the world followed the German model. So that's when we get back here that global humanitarian cooperation, which had worked so successfully during the refugee decade, was not followed. I tried to talk to officials of the major countries in Europe and the NGOs and others working there to suggest that we had a model. We have a model that works. We can use it almost immediately. But the die had been cast. There was not enough cooperation among governments even to make repatriation or regional settlement possible. During the buildup to the Syria crisis, when refugees were in asylum in Lebanon, Turkey, some even in Iraq, some in Egypt, the UN tried to raise money to support them in asylum. And for most of those years, the budget was about 50% subscribed. So the money to support people safely and decently was not provided. There was no leadership. This was one of those crises, I think, that was begging, as most have, for American leadership. But we didn't have any. And as a result, a new system came into play.
Yeah. Chip, we're talking about leadership here, but it's not just leadership. I want to read something you wrote about this. You wrote in the book, since the era of vast human upheaval in Indochina, I have been in a position to observe the rises and declines in global activism on behalf of the world's endangered, displaced, and disrupted people. As I have pondered and researched the world's response to the ongoing Syrian crisis, I am left heartbroken and angry. There have been no sustained humanitarian outcry. The world's conscience has been dormant, gone quiet, and governments have been left free to ignore or trivialize their moral obligations to humankind, to look away from the suffering. I have been astounded that the world's humanitarian advocacy community that played such a vital role in Indochina has been so weak as to be barely audible, and millions of innocent people have been killed, driven from their homes, or made destitute while seeking safety and help. So there's it's not just the governments that haven't been paying attention. You're saying some of the advocates that were there in the refugee decade are not here now, right?
That's right. We had, when I was director of the program in my State Department days, I had a number of advocates I could look to in the Congress. When we got into trouble and I needed help, they were supporters. The NGOs throughout our country would call me daily with offers of support, or if there were particular areas where they thought we were doing a poor job and needed to improve, they let me know, and they brought fantastic pressures to bear. But they made their presence known. The refugees had advocates. In state governments, state refugee commissions in each state, the NGO community, the international organizations. We had presidents who were very much pro-refugee people. The system was such that we encouraged advocacy on the part of the humanitarian victims. That doesn't happen now. It's beginning. I've noticed recently there are a number of organizations, one of them Refugees International, who is really doing a good job in trying to bring together the community to support many of the refugee communities around the world that are in dire straits as we speak. My own organization, the International Organization for Migration, and the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, are very much trying to blow the whistle. We've got to step in and do the job. But I think one of the reasons that we had such good results during the refugee decade is that we had presidents, Carter and Reagan, who were so supportive from day one, and they helped mobilize the response in their societies. That, to me, is a critical element that is missing presently. If you got just a minute, I want to read something from Reagan.
Sure.
I found this astounding. You know, when I was in the Carter administration, I knew that was ending. I knew that Reagan probably would get the Republican nomination, but I didn't know what to expect. I expected that I would be replaced, but I said, what will he do for the refugee program? He was an unknown. Well, he gave his acceptance speech July 17, 1980, in Detroit. Let me read. And when he finished his speech, he closed his book. Then he said, I got something else I want to tell you that's on my heart. And I'm going to read you just this one paragraph. He said, and this is extemporaneously, I have thought of something that is not part of my speech, and I'm worried over whether I should do it. Can we doubt that only a divine providence placed this land, this island of freedom, here as a refuge for those people in the world who yearn to breathe freely, Jews and Christians enduring persecution behind the Iron Curtain, the boat people of Southeast Asia, of Cuba and Haiti, the victims of drought and famine in Africa, the freedom fighters of Afghanistan and our own countrymen, held in savage captivity. I'll confess that I've been a little afraid to suggest what I'm going to suggest. I'm more afraid not to do it. Can we begin our crusade joined together in a moment of silent prayer? And then he said, God bless America. And I said, wow, you know, for a guy that's heading a weak refugee program, just beset on all sides, to have this kind of leadership coming in, that's remarkable.
It is. We are talking with James Purcell. He served as director of the U.S. State Department Bureau for Refugee Programs and director general of the International Organization for Migration. He's the author of We're in Danger, Who Will Help Us? Refugees and Migrants, A Test of Civilization. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly Marine Biological Laboratory Falmouth Forum Lecture Series conversation. We're talking with James Purcell, the former director of U.S. State Department Bureau of Refugee Programs, and he was director general of the International Organization for Migration, author of We're in Danger, Who Will Help Us? Refugees and Migrants, A Test of Civilization. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we've heard a lot in recent years about the harshness of the Trump administration's policies and actions regarding refugees and immigrants. So let's spend a few minutes assessing where we are as a new president is coming into office.
Okay, let me take the immigration program. This country, we have really two immigration programs, one for legal migration or immigration, and one for unauthorized migration. There is a feeling, and I try to be fact-based, and I know with your scientific audience, they like to be evidence-based. But I've been looking at the immigration scenario, and they would have us believe that we're almost about to collapse. that there are almost no immigrants coming in, that we set up these blockades, and that's true to some degree. But let me tell you a little bit about legal immigration. Normally, we have, in a normal year, we'll take in about 1 million legal migrants and about 9 million temporary non-immigrant visa. If you look back over the Trump years, you'll see that although the rhetoric has been harsh, there have been attempts to stymie the work. There have been over 400 executive orders and other executive action to try to stymie immigrants. The reality is that over the last 3 or 4 years, legal immigration has hovered still around 1 million. It's been a little lower, and then now with the pandemic, 2020 is going to be 50% lower. But that would be, I think, expected, which shows to me that it's our immigration system, even with the best efforts that people make, has some durability to it. It has survived what I say is a pretty vicious attack, but it's still standing. Now, who knows what some of these orders that have been put in to block legal immigration will have going forward, but that will be the challenge for the new president. The unauthorized migration system has really taken a big hit. It's virtually most unauthorized have been sent back. We've been blocked from coming. There are a lot of problems there. The real issue in the migration system, and I'll say it has three pieces: legal immigrants, unauthorized immigrants, and humanitarian immigrants. The humanitarian sector is the one that's taken the hit. We brought in about 3 million refugees since I created the program in 1980. I brought in as refugees, my book shows, during the refugee decade, 1.1 million of those. Throughout the remaining years of my time, some of which was spent in IOM, we brought in probably another 400,000 or 500,000. So during my time, we brought in about half of those that are here presently. We could see years where 200,000, 300,000. Now, over time, we've averaged about 85,000 a year, which is nothing's ever normal because it depends on crises. But last year, 2019, Trump cut it down to about 20,000. 22,000, I think, got in. This year, we expect 11,000. And we have rules that will block certain nationalities, particularly from 7 countries or 11 countries that are out of favor with the administration. But many of the implementation mechanisms that I established and that my successor regimes have established and strengthened no longer exist. The NGOs that supported refugee resettlement in this country and did a superb job, most of them don't exist anymore. They've been whittled back almost to non-existence. So Mr. Biden going forward has got a big job. And I will support all the efforts that he makes to address many of the dysfunctions of the present system. I will say during the last few years, there have been about 450 executive actions, including executive orders, that have been issued. I have been with a group of other former heads of the State Department Refugee Program taking action to try to revoke some of those. I've been amicus curiae on three. He put one that would call the public charge, say that no refugee coming in or immigrant coming in can impose, can be a public charge. But in that, he expanded the definition that I used, and I used it successfully. But he said you can't take food stamps. You can't take any support that is normal for sustenance. But I think the refugee regime is hit hard. I am pleased to see that Mr. Biden has said that he expects to, in his first year, establish a level of 125,000. Whether or not that's possible, I don't know. I always say that a level of refugees has to be related to other durable solutions that you're employing. As I mentioned, there are three of them, and they ought to be compatible. Whether or not that's happening anymore, I seriously doubt it. But 125 is a good start in the right direction. Yes. Might mention, under his regime of Biden efforts, he gave a list of 57 areas throughout our society that he's going to deal with. Under immigration, he put four. One was building the wall. He said he's not going to build another foot of it. Trump has already put, we'll say, have about 450 miles out of the 2,000-mile border completed when he leaves office. Mm. Biden says he will support a moratorium on deportations. He will support the banning of, says he will not, for sanctuary cities, he will try to aggressively limit local law enforcement cooperation with federal authorities. He previously opposed sanctuary cities.
Jim, let me ask you about an issue that's that global issue that really is impacting us on many levels, and that is climate change. How do you see climate change impacting this issue?
I think that will be one of our major challenges going forth. Say in refugee work, climate has always been a major factor. In my book, you will, if you read, and I encourage people to buy my book. I think much of what I've said here is elaborated many times over. But Africa was a continent of major climate disruption to the point we had to establish. I went to the Secretary General and got him to establish the separate agency, the Office of Emergency Operations in Africa. And we figure we helped African countries save over 1 million people when I felt that the major international organizations were not dealing with this issue aggressively enough. But climate change is big. How many? I heard yesterday a report by a group called Christian Aid, which is operating around the world, and they're trying to suggest we could have many, many climate migrants in the coming year. They estimate 1.2 billion climate migrants. I find that most other groups try to avoid making such a projection, and for a very good reason. When you make these vast projections, and many of them are not evidence-based, but they look at the world's disruption, how many people are presently displaced, and try to project from there how many of them might be climate migrants and how many more might there be. There's no doubt that there will be enormous. When I was in IOM, one of my key management officials has, for the last 2 years, served as the deputy executive secretary to the global climate climate conference. The last one took place last year. And we and IOM are looking at climate migration as a major issue. But one of the problems, if you blow the whistle without an evidence-based or fact-based support, what happens is that becomes anti-migration. Many people start trying to block migrants. And so most of the authorities that I know about are trying to look at more regional country and look at possible problems of, that will produce climate migrants, to help governments to begin already to anticipate and prepare. Now, you got in Ethiopia and Egypt, you got a major issue brewing over water. And what we'll see, and also climate is entering there. But most issues, as I found, have we try to bring the parties together. So before they result in massive disruptions, to try to solve the problems regionally, country by country, or even some communities. But you've got to balance, obviously, all of these issues off. What does it do to the ability of people to survive, to migrate if they need to? I see a lot of the migration I found in Africa and other regions is climate-based, and we've done our best to address it, but it is a massive problem and will be going forward.
We just have a couple of minutes left. I wondered if you'd tell us a little bit about Penina Tamano-Shata.
Okay. 9 years ago, 1948, my deputy Jean Doe and I were working in Sudan, trying to make it possible for a group to seek asylum there. There were Ethiopian Jews coming out of the Gondar region in Ethiopia. We helped them get into Sudan and asylum camps in Sudan. We found that they were not used to eating normal food, or their sanitary conditions left a little to be desired. We brought over specialists from the U.S. and from Israel to help. Eventually, we helped relocate them to Israel. My wife and I were able to travel to Israel after I left IOM, and we were hosted in one of the Falasha homes. It was amazing. The lady fed us popcorn. It was very generous and very appreciative of the fact that she had been helped through our program. Last year, one of those young girls who left at age 3, 34 years ago, has just been named in the new Netanyahu government as the Minister for Immigration and Absorption. She will be helping the 150,000 strong Ethiopian Jewish community there and the diaspora migrants who are coming from all over the world and to Israel. So this is what helps me remember. I want to say, refugees are special. They did something that caused themselves to be cast aside by their governments, but they didn't put up with it. They try to improve their local situation. They don't deal well with dictators. In the case of the Falasha, the Ethiopian Jews, they were being persecuted by a vicious communist regime, the Mengistu regime in Ethiopia. They didn't accept it. They fought back.
We are out of time, but that's a wonderful story, and thank you for sharing that. First Thursday of the month is our Marine Biological Laboratory Falmouth Forum Lecture Series. Today with James Purcell. He was director of the U.S. State Department's Bureau for Refugee Programs and director general of the International Organization for Migration, author of We're in Danger, Who Will Help Us? Refugees and Migrants, A Test of Civilization. Jim, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.